This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
Billy Reed, here we are in Florence, Alabama.
Yes, sir.
I love it. I was down in Baton Rouge about 2 years ago, and some dude knew you from back in the day.
Yeah.
And he said something. Oh, he was into coaching football.
Baseball.
Baseball.
Actually. But I did start school as a PE major.
Isn't that funny? You were left in the dust by somebody. You're still
player. Still there. Yeah. Well, my mom, she had a clothing store when I was growing up, and we may get into that in a minute, but I was always kind of around fashion, but I was also heavily into sports. Started as a PE major and wanted to be a coach. I somehow managed to flunk out as a PE major.
That's pretty hard to do,
but I did it. Yeah, I remember bringing my grades home, and I had a A in history and an F in social dance.
Wow.
And my dad was like, how in the hell do you get an F in social dance? You're social and you're out every night dancing. What the hell? How do you do that? Them cooler heads prevailed, and I was kind of directed to art school, Art Institute of Dallas, and went there. And
do you were intuitive, like a doodler, and you always work with your hands?
A little bit. I wouldn't consider myself a terrific sketch artist. I mean, that's kind of a learned technique for me.
Sure.
In some ways, but I was very much into clothes, how they were made and the structure of it and everything that goes into it, how, you know, the fabrications, how do you make textiles. And so for me, you know, I didn't have some master plan of like, I mean, obviously I started as a PE major.
Yeah.
It just kind of happened, you
that's
know,
so
and I got kind of, a lot of good experiences under my belt before I was able to.
So the do whole affinity with clothing and textile, does that go back to your mom?
Yeah, it goes back to my mom for sure. I mean, that's how I got my first exposure to it, and I just was always around it. You know, it's one of those things, it's just kind of it's in you, and you may not know it's there until you really start to use it and realize it. And yeah, that was definitely the baseline for things.
So that really evolved and gelled in art school. Right, your direction.
Probably even more so than that, when I was in school, I was working full-time. So I was going to school full-time and working full-time for Saks Fifth Avenue. And that was a point where I was able to really kind of...
In retail,
mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there I'm in a luxury clothing environment, working with men that have been doing it a long time, mm-hmm. men and women that have been doing it a long time, and being able to learn so much, you know, not only about garments and how they're made, but also the customer. And you know, this was the time of Harry Ellis was at his height, Giorgio Armani had just started, Ralph Lauren was obviously really starting to make a move, there was a designer by the name of Bill Robinson back then who unfortunately passed way too early, but those were people and designers I got, you know, firsthand exposure to all of that very early on, and I was just super infatuated with it, tried to absorb it as mm-hmm. much as I could.
So what transitioned you from selling clothes to making clothes?
Great question. Yeah, so I was with Saks. I graduated and kept working for them for about a year. And then I actually left that job without a job and moved to California with a buddy of mine. We wanted to be actors. We thought we were going to be actors. And that didn't quite pan out. So I ended up finding a job with Reebok. And Reebok was just starting to do their clothing line. This is back in the late 80s. And I actually started with them in sales. They were a pretty young company at that point. And then I worked on a project for them with Amnesty International, which was a big concert series. And they had an L.A. office. You know, worked there. Was then moved to New York to handle Foot Locker and Champ Sports, and where they would do things sort of outside of the regular Reebok stuff.
And but you were more on a marketing and sales level
still? A marketing sales, but yet also a little bit on the product side, merchandising side. And then I actually went to we had a sales meeting in Laguna Beach, and I walked into one of the meetings late, and they had just hired this guy as vice president of design. And I'm in the meeting about 5 minutes. He taps me on the shoulder and says, "Can you see me outside here?" And I'm thinking, "Oh man, I'm late. That's it. It's over. I'm done." And he goes, "Hey, I noticed the way you're dressed. You're not dressed like anybody else in here." And I had on like a sport jacket and jeans and tennis shoes, whatever. And everybody else was in sweatsuits. And he goes, "Have you ever thought about getting into design?" And I said, "Yeah, that's what I've always wanted to do, you know?" And he goes, "Well, I need someone to work with me hand in hand." He goes, "Are you interested?" And I said, "Absolutely." Mm-hmm. And the next week I started, and I was on a plane to Europe and then to Taiwan and everywhere, you know.
Why did you have to go around the world?
Well, we were sourcing, you know, you know.
So going to mills and stuff.
Yeah, going to textile mills, meeting with our suppliers and factories. And this was to help launch the Greg Norman, you know, the golfer, help a full lifestyle collection together, building out retail shops. And it was a very small team of people that was kind of doing the whole thing for Reebok, and I got to work on that, and I did that for 3 years before I left there. But that was kind of it was just thrown right into it, and it worked out great, and we grew that business for Greg Norman, and, you know, good things happened.
That's so cool. But at some point, you got the guts up to go out on your own, right?
I did. I mean, that took a while. I mean, I left Reebok and went to work for a very small company for about a year, kind of consulting and working for them, and then I went out on my own words, just strictly consulting, and my first client was Reebok.
Oh, wow.
So I was able to kind of pick up on some of that left
off. And consulting
off.
And was more material.
It was a little like freelance design, where I bring design concept, you know, be very specific things, whether we need a winter golf collection. Okay, give us your ideas for that. Or then I did a project with Fruit of the Loom Underwear, where they were trying to get into the boxer business.
Friends with Joe Boxer.
No,
he's my buddy.
No,
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, we can call
him. That was one of the – they were like, "We're getting competition from Hanes, people like Joe Boxer, and all we can sell are tidy whities." So I did a boxer project for them. Then I, you know, worked on when the PGA Tour started building the concept shops in the airport. I helped them – I did a project with them on the clothing collection and did some stuff for Neiman Marcus and literally just a lot of freelance design. And finally, it was one of those things where I felt like, man, I think can do this myself. And I had a couple of gentlemen that said, "You should really try to do something yourself. I think there's an opening for what you do, you know, for your look." So I got on a plane and went to Italy with some contacts I'd made through previous work and put a collection together. At the same time, my wife was pregnant with our first child. I was working out of my bedroom. She's pregnant. We're redoing the house. I mean, everything in chaos. We launched and had some pretty good success right off the bat.
Were you in New York at that time?
We were in Texas at the time.
Texas.
I'd moved back to Dallas. I'd moved back to Dallas. We were just, we got married. We were living in Boston because I'd moved to Boston with Reebok. And we just kind of wanted to get a little closer to friends and closer to home and in that environment. So it didn't take long before we had launched a collection. We started doing runway shows in New York, and I was living in New York in an apartment and commuting back and forth every week. And things went well until 2001, where we had just won this really great award from the CFDA for Best New Designer in June of 2001. And then our next runway show, kind of the breakout show during Fashion Week, was September 10th, the day before the terrorist attacks. And I mean, if you were in New York at that during that, everything just began to unravel. And my business partner at the time was in the .com business, and it was a perfect storm.
Yeah, no kidding.
And that's when we said we've moved here. My wife's hometown to Florence, and kind of just tried to put life back together. And she's one of nine children, huge family. We knew we'd have a lot of support. And
so you've basically been here in Florence, Alabama, ever since his home base.
Yeah. Wow. So, yeah. You know, and then we started Billy Reed in 2004 with some folks that kind of had retail background. And we thought we could partner with my product background with the retail. And we could create an environment around it and start from there. And I was like, we're going to do it from Florence, you know, and be different. And that will get people's attention, you know, because most fashion designers are either working in New York, Los Angeles, Paris, wherever. And yeah. I felt this would give us a point of difference. It'd give the brand a sense of place. And I'm comfortable here. And personally, I want to build my work around my life, not my life around my work.
Does the world come to you?
I don't know about that. We try to get them to come here. You know, in some cases, we got to get out and see the, get to the rest of the world.
So you still have to do New York.
Certainly COVID has. I mean, I was before COVID, I was going to, I think I took 25 flights to New York the last few years, every year. And we've realized through COVID that it's not necessary. I haven't been back to New York since COVID began.
So COVID was, in an indirect way, a major game shifter in Billy Reid's life.
Personally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, going through, there's a siren. Uh-huh. I may want to wait a second. Sorry.
So we just had our tornado siren test.
Yeah.
But it wasn't real.
No, thank goodness. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's segue for a moment to Billy Reid as an artist, that creative designer. One question for me is material, tactile, texture. How does that play? And then design pattern.
Well, both play. I mean, all of that plays huge, as well as color, into it. And it comes from so many different places. For instance, we could, you work with wood, and you can see subtle changes of color in wood textures and grains. Mm-hmm. And where someone might see a board, you might see these little subtleties. For instance, we're sitting here in the shop, and this is a reclaimed flooring from probably four or five different torn down houses. Mm-hmm. And the way the boards are constructed together, it could become, I may look at those lines and go, wow, that'd be a cool way to do a stripe, where the stripe isn't your typical stripe. Or mm-hmm. So really looking for subtlety. How can you find the fibers and yarns? It kind of comes from many different places. Looking at a side of a building, and you could see sort of the way the steel structure meets the brick. Mm-hmm. And I'll look at it and go, wow, couldn't we take that and that could become a plaid shirt, and then we use it in these colors. And yet, where the steel structure might be, we may say, well, let's do that. Let's weave it, the textile, in a way that pronounces the texture in that particular stripe. So I'm constantly looking at taking something that is somewhat traditional, mm-hmm. or may look traditional at first sight, but yet when you look closer, there's a lot of intricacy that makes it our own pattern. I mean, we try to develop all of our fabrics where they're ours, and mm-hmm. we really try to put all of those little details into the approach.
Do you sometimes do little ribs and high and lows?
Yeah,
definitely.
Surface interest, whether we're in the weaving technique or the knitting technique, or it might be the fact that you're mixing a yarn that might have a slub in it that gives it that kind of raised feel, mm-hmm. With a flat yarn. And so we approach every part of our design starts with the textiles and how we put those little touches in it.
And that being said, intrinsic in your world, I know from reading about you, has to do with longevity.
Absolutely.
That an expensive shirt is actually an inexpensive shirt because it will outlast 5-1, right?
Yeah, and I think for us too, we definitely look at that idea of, hey, yes, it's ageless or timeless or whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it. Some of those words are very overused, but when we look at it, I mean, we want to build it to last, and that's not just from a durability standpoint, it's from a style standpoint.
Uh-huh.
This shirt I'm wearing, I think we made 10 years ago, and it's still one of my favorite shirts. It's like, how do you build it where it's through detail, through some of those fabric manipulations, where it's unique enough to kind of stand on its own and have a point of difference. However, it's also built in a way that 10 years from now, it still looks relevant and appropriate.
What you're bringing to mind is reductionist and minimalist.
Yeah, absolutely. And at least where that minimal is something you might have to look to see some of the intricacy of it.
Well, it's kind of like Mies van der Rohe, form follows function.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And it's, I mean, I always say that I think we want to make clothes that live with you like a piece of furniture. You don't just throw out the leather chair. I mean, you want to keep it, and it's going to age, and hopefully it's going to get better as you wear it. And that's kind of, we try to look at it that way.
Interesting. Let's go local, regional for a moment.
Yeah.
You spend a lot of time in Alabama, sure. Texas, and whatnot, and I know you're interested in history. Do you ever go out and look at old historic photographs of what people wore and learn from that and apply that history?
All the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the time, whether it's books that I have or books that I find, or, of course, you know, you can get online and just research any subject and find a multitude of photographs. I love the research part of what we do, whether it's a certain muse that we're trying to figure out, a certain destination, mm-hmm. or, you know, I mean, being here in, you know, in the Shoals, Muscle Shoals, I mean, being able to go over to Fame Studios and see the wall of folks that have recorded there. I mean, just look, you know, you might see something on a shirt, the way it was stitched, or a collar shape, or just the mood of a photograph, and it's just kind of an endless, you know, for me, that part of it is just, it's the faucet that you can't turn off.
Right.
It has to be all the time, and I thrive on that. I really thrive on that part of things.
Going way back in time, historic photographs from the South, 1800s, were there any epiphanous images that you absorbed and applied in style, in the cut?
Some of the Civil War stuff had some really interesting, you know, this was very basic stuff, you know, think about it, the technology of making fabrics for the, whether it's for the Confederate uniforms or the Union uniforms, but but some of the metals on the buttons that were used. Now, I'm not looking at it, not trying to be political or anything like that, but just from a costume history standpoint, when you think about how they had to make those things, and they made it with purpose. I actually worked with some fabric mills that work with reenactment people.
Those guys are obsessive compulsive.
The detail has to be exact.
Yes.
And we were able to find this duck cloth that was made used for the tents. So it was just a cotton canvas, sort of somewhat water resistant. And we ended up making that fabric with them and using it and bags. And we actually made several pairs of pants and things out of the fabric, but came right out of that era. And we took it and completely modernized. Actually, one of my favorite pair of shorts that I have, we made in that blue, it's called Blue Line Duck.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So
literally kind of reviving a piece of history.
Yeah, just from a textile standpoint. Yeah. You know, and then we've actually, when we had some brass buttons we had put on a blazer, we worked with some folks that were making, you know, that were making the reenactment buttons for the Union Army suits. And we worked to make the brass buttons with them. And so,
have you applied any of those brass buttons in your wearers?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Cool. Yeah, we straight up, you know, we did it. This, I mean, it's been several years ago. And unfortunately, with American manufacturing, you know, lots of these, it's hard for a lot of these folks to survive. And they, you know, you might have been able to get it at one point, and then it's really been tough over the past 10-15 years of what's happened. So we're running out of suppliers of some of these things.
Interesting. Going random lateral, my wife, her aunt lived in Malibu, and her aunt, her favorite thing was to take my wife to iMagnons. Dress her.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go.
So she grew up.
Very nice.
Yeah. So she swears that the high point of women's fashion in America was World War II, the 1940s. Just elegant, classic, in this reductionist way. I mean, some of the pants and things they had, the high-waisted A-line. Did that ever resonate with you, the 40s fashion era in America?
Oh, yeah. That era was certainly, I think, going into the late 40s as well, you know, as well, when, you know, coming out of World War II, and there was such an energy in the country, you know, such a feel-good moment that it created all of these opportunities.
In a metaphor for the music, the big band.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and people were entertaining. They were socializing. And I they had to dress.
Dance was at an apex, too. And I'm extrapolating. I just thought probably that defined the way the dresses and pants were cut. Because you had to do these extreme physical moves.
Well, it's also, I mean, that high-waisted can be very flattering on... Not on everyone, right. You know, but...
You're
reasonably
slender, you're looking good.
You know, and then, you know, once you got to the 50s, it, you know, women's fashion completely shifted to Paris, you know, and that became so strong. But that was certainly a strong moment. I think there were some strong moments in the 70s, too, even though as crazy as it was.
Wasn't the 80s a weird decade?
I mean, the 80s were just a lot... I just call that the lost... decade, although I do think there was a lot of cool things happening in menswear. And of course, I think also with, I think Donna Karan's entry into womenswear in the 80s was huge. So was Norma Kamali. Those were two people that really understood the street and the application of everyday life through luxury clothing and the simplicity of it and the construction. And, you know, sort of that timeless idea, but yet they had such a point of difference. Yeah. I mean, two different points of view, Norma Kamali as far as shape, and just there were two of my favorite women's designers coming out of that.
I don't know why, but as a kid in the 50s, polka dot. I loved it. Is polka dot going to come back?
You know, it usually makes a little thing after it tries. You know, I think it's kind of like straight up Western wear. It's about every 5 to 7 years it makes a little, depending on what movies are out or what's happening. You know, polka dots, they're always there, but it you know.
It had its day.
It's kind of, I think for us, you know, we look at something like a polka dot. How do you take something like that and take the idea of it, but yet do it in your own way, make it modern? Do you change the shape of it? Do you change the space? Do you, you know, weave it in an interesting way, or do you mix it with something else? I'm always trying to, like, take something that's so obvious or, you know, in a polka dot, I mean, immediately you know exactly what that is. Like, how do you do that and make it look completely new?
Let's talk Billy Reid. Irreverence and playfulness. Do you go there?
I mean, I guess so. Yeah, I guess so.
So you're willing to take risks just for the adventure, right?
Oh, I think definitely you want to experiment. I mean, if you don't experiment, it's hard to do.
Yeah.
Create something fresh. But, you know, I think ultimately, too, you experiment with intent. With the fact that ultimately we have to put clothes on a rack that people are going to buy.
Right.
You know, we could get out here and make spacesuits and pat ourselves on the back for all the creativity we put into it, but who the hell is going to wear a spacesuit walking down the street? Like, how do you, at this point, the challenge is finding the subtlety that is so unexpected, but yet still has that longevity of something that somebody's going to wear 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is the balance. And that, I don't know if that's irreverent. I think the premise for our whole company and the way we did things was irreverent. You know, we did it from a place that no one was doing it from and was, you know, able to make it successful and still be in the conversation,
right?
You know?
Kind of a visual, tangible example. In what ways? How you stood out and were willing to stand out?
I would say by us basing ourselves here, I believed that if we did it here and was rebooted, you know, basically, certainly after what happened to us after 9/11, that people would give us an opportunity to at least hear us out. Because we were there, and we had that advantage of being in New York and being a part of Fashion Week and all of that. So I felt like if we could get started again, and the way we started back before with the collection William Reid, which is what it was called in, you know, in its previous life, when I was during, you know, during the 9/11 things and everything, we did not have stores. We sold to other people, to Barney's, to Neiman Marcus, to place, you know, those types of places. We didn't have our own stores. So we were completely dependent on on what's the wholesale model.
Right, right.
Selling to somebody else.
So now is retail?
When we started back in 2004, we did the complete opposite. We only sold it in our stores. Wow. So we were able to build it exactly the way we wanted to build it and, you know, create a customer for our own. That was irreverent. We didn't have the, because of wholesale, if Neiman Marcus bought it and they said, well, you know what, we're going to put you in 50 stores. Well, good gracious, that's huge.
Yeah.
We got one store and then three stores. So we're having to sort of create that customer one at a time through the relationships. Hopefully they like what we're making. That was kind of a risk for sure, but it worked. And then once we got it going, we felt if we could bring folks to our headquarters in Alabama, I mean, our first store was in an old house built in 1832.
Cool.
There used to be an antique store. My mom's store, when I was growing up, was in my grandmother's old house, had a kitchen. It was more of an entertaining kind of situation. And we took that vibe and modernized it. And we felt if we could bring those folks here, show them that, obviously take them through the collection, but then also take them through the cultural points of interest, tell them about Muscle Shoals music. At that time, the movie wasn't out. You know, so we'd take them to the studio. We'd spin records in there. My brother-in-law's a historian. So they
must have been blown away.
They were blown away. Yeah. And the idea is, like, if we can get the Wall Street Journal here, we can get New York Times and all of these GQ, all of these people, that they'll come here and then they'll go tell other people about it.
Right.
And that's what happened. Before you know it, that little weekend that we created turned into what is now Shindig, a festival where, you know, it's chefs and musicians and artists and photographers, and it's sort of a cultural Camelot for, you know, one weekend in Florence, and it attracts people from all over the place.
That's so cool. I love it. I could go on all day with you.
No, I got time. All right. It's all good. I'm giving you long-winded answers.
No,
has such a backstory, and after all these years.
Well, luckily, I do long form. People in our society,
you can take it, and
but some people are 3-second little Instagrams. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, my philosophy is either you're going to be into it or you're not.
Yeah.
Like with This American Life, that podcast.
Yeah, of course.
I never listen to the whole thing at once, but I go back and finish it up.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And that's the beauty of digital media. Where I was going, as an aside, I don't know if you know or not, but I'm travel editor of Civilian Magazine in New York.
Yeah,
which is
freaking fantastic. No, they've got a good thing going.
They do such a beautiful graphic job, man.
Yeah, no, it's...
Some magazines, I open them up and it's painful, man.
Yeah, we've been fortunate. They've had some editorial stuff of ours occasionally, and they do a great, beautiful photography. Yeah. Man. Well,
the editor knows that I'm here with you, and their most important thing, they want to get from you guys, oh my God, cool, professional images.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm their travel editor. I know nothing about fashion, but I have no fear, you know. So, yeah, I'd love to do this. So what we decided would be a Florence, Alabama travel / fashion piece.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it's you and then Natalie.
Yeah.
But from you, what I need, Billy Reed's itinerary. If you had somebody coming from New York or wherever.
To here.
You know, your hit list. What are the must-dos on Billy Reed's travel world? Yeah.
Wow, put me on the spot.
well, you
probably
did it before.
Yeah, I would. You want to go to Trowbridge's, a sandwich ice cream parlor that was, I think it was 1918, so it's 103 years old.
This is in Florence?
It's in Florence on Main Street. Hasn't changed since it was built. I mean, the prices have barely changed since then. It's like going back in time a little bit, and it's well worth to get the sandwiches that they grill off the butter wheel and, you know, your chicken salads. You got to do that. I think you need to definitely tour the music studios just to get a vibe of that. I would recommend that you watch the Muscle Shoals documentary just to give you a sense of like what happened here. And a part of that movie, there's actually at the beginning, they visit a place called The Wall. Tom Hendricks.
I went there. What a trip.
Spiritual.
One dude?
Yeah. over his lifetime.
Yeah.
Built this memorial wall.
Stone by stone.
Stone by stone. Yeah, pretty epic.
It's so understated. It's incredible how many people get it. That, like you said, that spiritual, intensive energy.
Absolutely. I would recommend having dinner at Odette. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Right next door to our shop here.
Was there last night?
Yeah. I mean, the bar's fantastic. They have one of the best bourbon selections in the country. It's fantastic. The guy, the bartender there, Brian's fantastic. Or he's kind of curates the whole bar scene there. Mm-hmm. And then again, the chef, Josh, man, highly recommend it. Menu changes often, but their cheeseburger is fantastic. And it never is off the menu. They can't take it off.
I wish I had known, because that was just intuitively, that's what I was going to order last night, but then I went sideways and didn't. So now I regret that.
Oh, that's all right.
That's so cool.
I mean, if you have a chance to get on the water somehow, I mean, we're just surrounded by water here. Mm-hmm. Whether you go, you know, down to McFarland Park and kind of hang out there.
You can kayak on the rivers?
You can kayak on the, yeah, actually, we have a Cypress Creek, mm-hmm. which is runs into the river, connects it. You can easily, it's great kayak in Little Creek, just perfect. And there's public access. There's actually a park, Wildwood Park, where you can completely access the creek from there. Mm-hmm. Super cool. You know, the TVA trail for biking, fantastic, or walking. It's right here, right on the water, right on the river. It goes for miles. What else am I missing?
Well, I think the mothership is definitely Fame and Shoals Studio. Yeah. That was the most mind-blowing in my personal experience, because Nashville and Memphis just do such a great job of making you think that the world began and ended. And for any musician there, right?
Yeah.
They never talk about Shoals.
Yeah. For years, I always said this is the greatest music story never told.
Yeah.
You know, we kept...
The Rolling Stones.
Rolling Stones, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, I mean, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, Liza Minnelli, Paul Anka, the Osmonds. I mean, literally thousands of people. I mean, the list is... For a while, there was a local radio station that only played Muscle Shoals music are musicians connected to Muscle Shoals music. For instance, the Muscle Shoals horns, they backed up John Lennon, you know, on the album Whatever Gets You Through the Night. The horns, that's the Muscle Shoals horns. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia Freedom, the horn section on Elton John, that was the Muscle Shoals horn. They played music, backed music for so many people. So this radio station, basically,
the playlist. Totally.
Endless playlist. Those are places I would recommend. I mean, I would try to get some barbecue while you're in town, mm-hmm. as well. We're the pulled pork, but there's a place in town. It's got a couple of tables, a little more of a takeout, but mm-hmm. I'll sometimes just get takeout and go down the river and sit and eat, you know, like a picnic. But it's called Bunyan's. Been there for, I don't know, since the 50s. Well, it's kind of a little bit of a out of the way. Mm-hmm. Somewhat, I mean, it's 5 minutes from downtown, but highly recommend Bunyan's Barbecue.
Cool.
Get the slaw and get a slaw dog mm-hmm. as well.
So you need to book at least a week here, right? If not two, for a little getaway.
Yeah, it's absolutely a really great weekend kind of town. As well, mm-hmm. you know. Plus, we have a Big Bad Breakfast here, which is a fantastic brunch spot.
That's the name,
Big Bad Breakfast. Right. Yes, a chef, John Currents, good friend of ours. He started that concept, and
so your culinary scene here in the middle of nowhere, in one respect, relative to big giant cities, is happening.
It's happening. You know, some of it is some of that well-established mm-hmm. kind of the.
The regional.
Yeah, the regional go-to mm-hmm. kind of things. But then you have this other kind of thing popping up with, you know, like Odette and what they're doing. And then, you know, you have a Big Bad Breakfast. And then there's an Asian restaurant in town. The chef, Paul, who owns it, is out of this world good.
You do realize you're spoiled, right?
We're definitely spoiled here. But it's changed. I mean, I would also recommend people come to our shop. I mean, we've done a...
You're right on Main Street.
We're right on Main Street, right in the middle of all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, when we moved here 20 years ago, you could come down here on a Saturday night and shoot a cannon off and not hit anything. Mm-hmm. And now... You can come down here on a Tuesday night and you can't find a parking spot.
So over what period of time?
This is over the last 20 years. But I'd really say over the past 10 years, the growth and the just how it's developed and the energy, it's just completely changed. I mean, we've been a small part of that. I mean, when I think, you know, we have folks here that work with us and visit us from all over the world.
Right.
That... And they're young people, and they're creative people. And when you bring those people, that kind of energy into a small southern town, and you mix it with the locals, that all starts to gel together. It is just a truly, truly energetic and amazing thing to witness. And it's happened. And you see this progressive kind of vibe and energy throughout the town. I mean, Rivertown Coffee Shop. You can go there, and you, at times you think, am I in Brooklyn? You know, because you, it's got that vibe. Mm-hmm. You'll see folks walking in there that dress like that.
That's
By
funny.
The way, highly recommend probably some of the best food in town, Rivertown Coffee Shop.
Cool.
My goodness, whether it's for breakfast or lunch, man, highly, highly recommend anytime.
Interesting. So you grew up near New Orleans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Are there any kind of comfort zones here that remind you of...
You know, I would say that Louisiana is its own unique thing. It's like we're like our own country.
We're downtown or the Caribbean.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of those similarities. Mm-hmm. I think the way of life, there's some similarities. Food-wise, completely different. My family would be eating and, you know, completely different, you know. I mean, I grew up Cajun food, so,
right.
You know. And it's kind of hard to get that anywhere else, but in Louisiana, at least if you're from Louisiana, you'll say that.
I'm almost from Louisiana.
Yeah, where
my great grandparents moved to Metairie in like 1880.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
My grandfather was manager of the Fulton Bag and Tent Company in Metairie.
Huh.
When my dad was in high school, my grandfather got transferred to Minneapolis plant owned by the same Metairie company.
And that's how they got into the Zero King.
He married into that family.
I gotcha.
But that's how I became a northern boy rather than a southerner.
Yeah.
It was just a fluke of a transfer.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
And then my great-grandfather owned the Florsheim shoe store in Natchez.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then... They had come from Murfreesboro before that.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. The culture, Louisiana is such its own thing, and I love that. I'm very proud to be from there, and my family's there, and, you know, I carry that with me everywhere I go. Yeah. I mean, I can't take that out of you. And most people from Louisiana feel that way. They're so proud of that culture, you know, and you kind of wear it.
Mm-hmm. There's also, being small town, there's that talking story, you know, that everybody's telling you tales all the time.
Absolutely, all the time.
Yeah. All right, well, I'll come back and we'll do a reprise because I just had the greatest morning with you.
Man. Oh, man, well, I've definitely enjoyed talking with you. I'm going to go ahead and brag on you for a second as well, looking at your woodwork, and that's immediate connectivity because you mentioned something, and I not to take up too much of your time,
no,
but
I got
when you
all
talked
day.
About... how you went to construction scrap piles and recycling. That's been our approach and how we build our stores.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, yeah, so the, when you look, the wood, you can, I mean, you can notice just from the texture on the wood. I mean, this is all reclaimed.
So wherever
type
you
wood.
Can, whenever you...
Absolutely.
That's central.
I mean not everything can be done that way.
But when you can.
When we can, I mean, or we try to take recycled things, you know, like... The cylinder that was at a park probably was a trash can receptacle at one point.
Right, right.
But then we took it, refurbished it, had this cool marble top that we found, and there it becomes sort of an elegant table. You know, it's we really try to make these things where they reuse something that could be thrown away. And then even after the job
is
done.
So it truly is philosophical with that reuse.
Oh, man. It's something I believe in from the standpoint of we should not be creating waste, but it's also... I just love working with it. Yeah. It's great to take something that somebody throws away and make something brand new out of it that's just is more beautiful than it was. You
so
know?
That's a motif in Billy Reed retail stores wherever?
All of our shops are that way. And that's just our mindset and how people that work with us believe. It's how we our house is like. I mean, that's how we do it. Matter of fact, we had a job, one of our stores, what store was it? I think it was D.C., and we had this really cool kind of reclaimed flooring that we'd done in this patchwork, and it did, it created some waste. Little pieces, you know, long, you know, 18 inches long, and the construction crew put it in a big pile. They were going to throw it away, and I'm like, uh-uh. And put it on the truck. Let's bring it back because we're about to throw this away, and, you know, it sat here, and then I said, all right, the scrap stuff, I'm taking it, you know, because we're about to throw it away. I used it. The guy I work with, Sam, who does a lot of our carpentry work and for us, takes it, all different widths of floors, planes it down, does this beautiful floor out of this trash lumber.
Wow, how cool.
And on our back porch. I love that idea of reusing things.
Well, and talk about stable, well-cured wood. Not going to warp or shrink on you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's my outlet.
Well, just like you, this guy had a job he was doing, and the carpenters were cutting 4x4s, and they had like 4-inch long ends, butt ends of these 4x4s. He had them lay an entire floor of 4x4s, scrap, and then had the guys grind it, you know, sand it, and it became this beautiful floor. And as you know, end grain is so strong.
Yeah. My neighbor was putting in a new porch, and she had these oak flooring that she put in. When the construction guys were, they were shaving off about inch and a half off each board, full length, these little strips. And I looked outside the door, and there was a just a giant stack of these skinny little strips.
Oh, cool.
And I called Sam. I said, I took a picture.
And where did they put it?
On the street. They were about to throw it away. So I called Sam, and I said, look, we got to do something with this. So I just said, I'm taking it. And I just took it, put it in the back of the truck, brought it out there, and we built a whole wall with it, these little strips, full width. Nice. So they're like...
That's in your house? Or?
It's in our cabin. We built it in the cabin.
How cool.
But
I love that, I love man. So we're brothers in the trash and rust.
We're like Sanford and... We're the Sanfords here. We got it.
Yeah. I love it. It's so cool.
My garage looks like I'm just... always in bad shape because I just grab stuff and throw it in there and not know what you're going
to
do.
Same with my garage. You have to climb around and over stuff.
Yeah. It's like, I can't throw it away. Someday I'm going to do something with
it. And isn't it cool? Then right when you're ready to give up and heave it, then a week later it finds a perfect home.
Something clicks. It happens. I'm sure that was one right there.
Like, oh, the trash bin one.
I was like, what are we going to do with this? Anyway.
All right. Well, regretfully, I'm going to say goodbye. You promise next time I come to town, go to lunch or something?
Absolutely. We're going to hit you up. Maybe get some bunions.
That would be cool.
And it would be great. So at Rivertown's too, man. You should.
Do you kayak?
I don't. My son does a little bit. He and his buddies.
I love to kayak. Yeah. Downstream.
Man. Yeah, we definitely going down. We going downstream. We going. That's for sure. But man, if you want to do that, I mean, now my brother-in-law's got all the equipment.
Cool. Well, if you come to Morro Bay, California, Central Coast, I have three ocean scuppers take you out on the bay.
Oh my gosh.
We have little sea otters that come up and visit you.
Wow.
Oh, it's so cool.
I bet it's beautiful.
It's beyond. Yeah.
That house sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Well, we have a whole 1,000-foot downstairs apartment now that's empty. She used to rent it out, but COVID world, we gave up. So you got a place to stay. Okay, so we got to wrap. Billy Reed, just a wonderful honor, pleasure to hang with you this morning, man.
Honored to be a part of it. Thank you so much.
Very cool. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Florence, Alabama. We've been visiting with Billy Reed. We'll see you down here.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Well, I'll be turning 33 next Friday morning. Friday morning 15 years ago, my grandfather called me to his bedside, and he told me there was something I should know. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see. So I loaded up my car and moved to Denver to work a job and chase big city dreams. But I never found the life I really wanted till I came back home to Leaper's Fork, Tennessee. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see. It didn't hit me quite as hard then as those words come through today. But in the chaos all around me, I can still hear Grandpa say, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, and the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see.